Welcome to Try Not to Blink. Today's show is going to review our favorite scleral lens materials that we prescribe in FitRip. We'll discuss challenging scleral lens cases, and then we've invited a scleral lens troubleshooting guru, David Slater, to discuss the uber customized options in scleral lenses and provide top troubleshooting tips for all scleral lens fitter.
Classically, let's say you have a lens that's looking tight temporal or something like that. They have a nasal pinguicula. Most of the time, people are going to want to flatten like that temporal side right to relieve that pressure. But what they should really be thinking about, in my mind, is look at the nasal side. Look at the other side of the eye that's higher in elevation that's forcing that lens to move temporal, right? So a lot of the time, if you flatten that nasal side, you'll actually get the lens to center up better in that case. That's something I always like to consider, especially with pinguicula patients.
We'd like to thank the amazing people at Valley Contacts who have made this podcast possible. They are the makers of the stellar gas permeable lenses and the incredible custom stable scleral lens. I'm your host, Dr. Roya Habibi, and joining me is Dr. Sheila Morrison. Sheila, let's talk a moment about materials. Okay. Obviously, there are, you know, different material options available. Just tell me your go-to. Is there a go-to, or do you kind of play around with different materials?
I think it depends on the lens manufacturer. So some companies are going to use certain buttons. And so quite often I'll stick with kind of the higher level DK of what is available within a company. Okay. And then reserve some of the really, really high DK materials for patients that get edema, things like that. So I would say probably honestly, like Boston XO is very common. It's used in a lot of different lenses that we use. I think that's about like a DK of about 140. That would be, I would say, the most common material that we're using right now. How about you?
You know, a couple years ago when there was all of the, you know, chit-chat about the Boston material and it got more expensive and this and that, and I think that's changed since, but I actually made a transition to almost exclusively Contimac materials.
Contimac, yeah.
And so my go-to for a while was Optimum Comfort. That's got a DK of 65 until, so Extra felt like Optimum Extra's DK of 100, and I like, obviously 100 is great, but I thought, you know, sometimes there's a wetting issue, although I never really had that. And then I transitioned to Extra being my staple, and Extreme was when I needed more. So yeah. Optimum Extreme has the 1.5.
Let's talk about what do you notice when you, because you know, when you go up in DK, the perception and what sometimes happens is you lose a little bit of wetting. Do you notice that when you switch around with the materials?
Honestly.
Say you go to a higher DK.
I don't.
Yeah.
But maybe.
I don't.
Like, sometimes I'll be in these different scleral lens fitting forums and I'll see how people are talking about material and this and that.
Yeah.
And I don't really like. Maybe if I'm just, you know, I do use Hydropeg. I do prescribe Hydropeg on many lenses.
Okay.
So if anyone has drier eyes, I just straight up go to that. Or maybe I will order the lens proactively without it. Or sometimes, honestly, I'll do one with it, one without it, if I just want to like straight up play around with it a little bit. And I'm just not sure if the patient will notice. And then they'll say, my left is so much more slippery and soft than my right. And I'll be like, oh, well, I'll add Hydropeg to the other eye, right? So,
yeah. I have a correction to what I said too. XO, so the XO is 100, XO2 is the 140.
Mm-hmm.
Most Contimac is, the Contimac buttons are also, we use them very commonly depending on the manufacturer. Mm-hmm. Okay, how about this then? Do you have anybody that you ever run into that doesn't do well with Hydropeg when you prescribe it?
Yes, sort of. Usually it's like they don't like how slippery it is for some reason.
It like falls on the ground or they pick
yeah,
it up
like
and
I don't really get it, but like sometimes I'll order it just knowing that they have drier eyes or whatever the indication is, or they're more sensitive. And if they get it and hate it, either I say, you know, wash it with, you know, your extra strength cleaner and it's going to basically be gone anyway, or I'll just reorder without it. But it doesn't come up that often. Honestly, most people do like it once they get used to the handling of it. But I do think it's worth, I mean, granted it costs more. So usually you're going to be talking to the patient anyway. You usually don't surprise them with this option because you're probably not to charge for it. But I usually warn them, people like how this feels, But some people do say it's more slippery. It's just different to handle. So just keep that in mind. And also your cleaning habits are important with this. So you might need to clean it a little differently, or you might need to, if you like the extra strength, if you feel like you use that a lot, you're going to wipe it off. So we're going to make this investment and it's going to be gone right away. So anyways,
any allergies with Hydropegue? And I'll tell you about a case I'm dealing with trying to troubleshoot some toxicity that she's been experiencing with Hydropegue lenses. Although I don't see it, just to be clear, I don't see allergy with Hydropegue much, if at all. I've heard that it can happen. Have you ever seen that?
I don't think I ever did, but tell me what you saw.
Well, so I have a patient, she's a PKP, habitual lenses fitting, touching kind of like a steep inferior kind of edge of her graft. And so her habitual lenses that she loves, but I hate, bear on her inferior cornea. Yeah. She feels nothing. She loves them. So clearance is less centrally as well than the new lenses I got her, which are the same material. Aside from the only difference is the new ones have Hydropegue, the old ones didn't, and the new ones have more clearance. So she has presented over, like, I've gone back and forth to try to troubleshoot and figure out, she'll get this discomfort when she wears the new lens, fit looks perfect. She comes in, I take the lens off, and she has what looks like global toxicity staining. So I'm thinking this patient is definitely not rinsing off the solution that she's using. She's putting something in the bowl that she's not supposed to. But honestly, I actually believe her that she's using the exact same cleaner, which is ClearCare. She rinses it with saline, like with a preserve-free saline and Addy pack, equally the same with both lenses. So let's say all solution use is equal. The only differences would be there's more clearance beneath the new lens and the Hydropegue. And she keeps presenting whenever I go back and forth to try to figure out why she doesn't like it with what looks like global toxicity. So I'm trying to sort that out. So I just ordered a lens in that does not have Hydropegue, and I'll report back at the next session to let you know how it goes. But I do remember early on in the day, there were, I remember when I was at Houston, there was one provider that felt like some patients just didn't really do well with that coating. So I was curious if you've ever had that, because I haven't really, but I'm wondering if this patient is allergic to Hydropegue. I don't know. I don't know why they could be or how they could be, but yeah, it's interesting. The other time I'll switch patients' material just in general will be if there's an issue with something that's different than what they're used to. So say if I did have like a non-wetting issue, somebody with really bad tears and dry eye or something like that, and there happened to be something that their tears were more compatible with.
Sure.
And I switch, I'll put them back if they're not happy. And often it ends up being about the same, but sometimes the plastic works a little better for one person than the other. But on average, I don't really see non-wetting these days with the solutions we have.
Totally.
It's usually pretty, like if they're conditioned, if everything's like fresh plastic makes a huge difference. Patients that have old lenses are not going to wet. They get a little bit, micro abrasions and things like that. So if you replace your lenses with the modern plastics and cleaning products that we have, non-wetting is not something that I see near as much as I used to.
Totally agree. I mean, honestly, there are the outlying cases that are always like the biggest headache and heartache. But in general,
such a pee off to have non-wetting be the problem.
Heartache. Yeah, everything's perfect, but the weddings have non-wetting is just a definite heartache. I do want to bring up one I forgot to talk about is the Optimum Infinite, which is the 180 DK lens.
Yep.
I've been tapping into that a little bit too. I think that, so there's two groups of patients that we could talk about when it comes to troubleshooting, especially when it comes to materials. It's the patients that have like the severe dry eye or like...
Exactly. Totally.
You know, neuropathy, whatever, that you're just chasing different materials for one reason or another. And those I don't find a difference for. But it's the other patients with like ocular disease, maybe they have an old graft or whatever, that I do it strictly for a DK purpose, right? So I find that like in theory, extra or extreme kind of... the DK of a 125 to 100 should be a go-to in general. Like, I think that you should just be fitting your lenses around that, because anything you can do, we already know a certain thickness of the lens. We probably shouldn't mess with that too much to get prevent flexure or, you know, to have good stability, but going too thick is obviously a problem as well. So if you can limit every variable and have a good DK and when lens wetting, whether you need to add Hydropegue or not, like that's the way to go, right?
Mm-hmm. And you know, another thing that's worth chatting about is when it comes to decay, we think of, or I think of anyways, oxygen, right? And so if we're going a horse, so however, there are so many factors that go into oxygen permeability, and like fit matters, like how much 100%. Space for the air to travel from the front of that lens through whatever decay through their tears. And then corneal metabolism is individual for every patient. So there's a lot of different things. Fitting a lens that's a very aligned fit versus a lens that you have a bit of, you know, tear exchange, that's going to be a completely different thing. So what is the most important thing to correct edema is, you know, decay obviously plays a role, but I don't think we have the answer, you know, if that's the bile end all, which in fact, I actually don't think it really is. Yeah. I think all the other things need to be considered as well, rather than focusing just on that material. Although I will, like I said, I'll throw somebody who I'm really struggling with, already fenestrated a lens, you know, loosen the edges so there's movement, made it as close as it's safely possible, and thrown in a 200 DK material if they're, you know, and often that could be the thing that makes the difference and helps them.
Yeah. Or lets them wear the lenses a little longer. Like that's the time that I think is worth it.
Yeah, for sure.
I can only
wear
the lenses 4 hours before what is obvious cornea edema, right? So like that's the kind of time.
Rainbows and halos or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's go. You and I had talked about this recently, but talking about getting referred these patients that have these very challenging needs for fitting scleral lenses. And specifically speaking, I want to talk about referring for iPrim prosthetic, which as we know is an impression-based fit for scleral lenses, or for even just whether it's impression-based or scan fit, these free-form lens designs. So I want to talk about a couple challenging cases. Like what are examples in your opinion? Like there are the obvious reasons everyone knows of, or everyone can assume of, why they are good. But I want to talk about when it doesn't really work, right? Because like in my practice, I noticed that people were referring me patients, even a simple example, someone was referring me patients for eye print fitting that wasn't necessary, right? So sure, we want to offer the best technology. And usually if someone came in with that intention, I was going to definitely discuss it. But the real indication was, the real reason that they were being referred is maybe because the referring provider really couldn't nail the haptics for the patient's eye. And so they weren't having a comfortable fit, or they were getting a lot of redness in the eye or whatever. So that's
totally,
like kind of like an obvious one. But what are some other challenging cases that you've come across that I don't know, that are worth discussing?
Like when do we go straight to like a free form versus another style of lens?
Yeah. Or even like,
yeah,
when does
I think for sure.
That, and also the latter of like, when is it so challenging that actually you need to go back to the basics? And if this isn't going to work, right? Like,
yeah,
let's talk about
definitely.
Both for a sec.
Well, I think like, so the first thing that I really consider, there's two pieces, and one is, you know, the human in front of you. So where do they live? What is their time like? What are they expecting? So that's half of it. And then the other side would be, so a comprehensive physical workup just to see what their shape truly is. Any, like patients that I see that have, for example, like a really narrow, proud graph. So it's like a very ectatic, narrow shape that it's not likely to be able to accommodate, even if we adjust the mid peripheral cornea to the max and other designs, I may be inclined to just go straight into an impression driven lens right off the start, just because from experience, I know we're not going to be able to max out those parameters to accommodate that really steep, narrow, proud shape.
So just I think those, for layman's terms, when graft is so proud, but your limbus is so flat, that you will have such significant clearance over there with any standard fit, or you can't center the lens? Or
Yeah. And so, and if the button, like, or any, even like a keratoglow, something, some shape on the front of the eye, that the ectasia is, the diameter of it is actually quite small, because relative to the shape of the whole cornea.
Yep.
Because when we have that, it's basically like a big beaky, you know, narrow bump centrally. And even some of the greatest is that there are limitations when it comes to contact lenses, really. Like, there's only so much we can do to bring the mid-periphery in on some designs. Although, I mean, the ability to change pretty much every design is just going up and up and up. I mean, really, I'm really grateful for our manufacturing partners that make things so, things that we never thought we could do with a certain design we can do now. But those also that have, I'll look at what lenses are on the market that have the highest safety features available. So if we have a very low endothelial cell count, for example, patient who has a history of failures from, not just from fit or discomfort, but from swelling. But first, you nailed it, Roya. We have to look at what the reason for that failure is. Is it really because they need a printed lens, or is it because the lens that they came in wearing had, you know, 400 microns of clearance and the fit was just not optimal within the design that they're in? So exactly. Yeah, there are some patients, but if you talk about the people as the whole, I'll have patients that come in that really, truly, even ones that are local, that are better served on, you know, a design that is more likely to be kind of one or two and done, mm-hmm. and kind of skip the line. And those people that don't mind the extra cost, we just put them in a printed lens or a free form earlier on.
Yeah.
But there are people that we say, like, I have a hard line and it's a big no. I think that when we're dealing with patients who come in with ocular surface disease, they need a diagnostic lens on. And patients that could potentially suffer from pain or neuralgia, those patients, I actually had a lady who was referred and asked for, she came in expecting to pay for a full, you know, eye print lens, and she wanted that. That's what she was there to see us. And I actually declined, because in patients like that, a scleral lens is not proven to solve their problem yet. And so we want to choose a lens that we can fully return if we needed to, or one that to really test the process before we go to that length. And then we can always upgrade if we really needed to. But on dry eye, more regular shapes, where the irregular, that's not really as much of an indication. Like, they've got a fairly regular shape, but big symptoms. I mean, I don't really see a big advantage in doing a printed lens, you know, in those. In fact, it can be a disadvantage because we haven't proven yet that the contact lens will solve their problems.
Totally. Well, and I can say exactly an example like that. I had a patient, we had a really nice fitting, actually a custom stable lens. It fit beautifully. I went through a lot of efforts to make it perfect. She had neuralgia. She had this ongoing pain. And eventually she actually flew to another doc to get a eye print fitting, although I actually could have done it for her, but she kind of made it a little complicated. So anyway, she flew for the fitting, was fit in eye print lenses, and then hated them, and then ended up eventually back in the same lenses that I fit. Like, that's what she loved the most.
Oh, too funny.
The smaller lens diameter, which obviously we all love Bally, and their lens is beautiful. And there's, you know, a scleral lens generally based on the same technology is going to do similar things for patients. But that particular type of case is very tricky from the get-go. So if you aren't confident in your ability to fit the sclera, sure, a scleral lens fit with an impression is going to help provide the most comfortable fit. But on the same, like, exactly to your point, is it actually going to fix their problem? Someone who is just desperate for a solution, maybe, maybe not. And so that is, it is a fine line to tiptoe around, because you don't want to just, I don't know, that's a fine line. And I think it's, I'm proud of you for actually declining that, because sometimes it is easy to say, okay, let's get this in. This can be one and done. We'll figure out the best fit for you and see if it helps. But it also, mm-hmm. like, we don't want to capitalize on somebody who is struggling and desperate.
I have to say, too, that there are, like, when it comes to should we be recommending, say, like, if it's, you know, a higher cost or whatever, there are wonderful fitting guides to get a lens almost in the first or second fit for a variety of our manufacturers. You know, like, absolutely. Valley, for example, just because you just mentioned, I, like, couldn't agree more with the process for fitting based on, like, a fitting guide. And that often, especially on eyes, and this is, I'm not talking the steep, proud graph that I'm just, you know, there are patients that'll go straight to something different. But again, that's just a small subset of the patients we serve to fit in scleral lenses. And again, like I said, I'm just amazed every year when we roll around and look back where we came from 12 months ago to now, the customizations that are available in literally almost every scleral lens design on the market. It's less of an issue of, like, what can this lens do and not do? It's like, do I know how to use this lens to its full capability 100%. Anymore? Because they're always changing. So that's where the challenge would be put out for either, probably actually for both of us and for any listener, is to continue to learn what is available and become even more of an expert than you thought you could be in whatever lens design that you're using, to actually use it to its full potential before you throw in the towel on it.
Amen, sister. I want to talk about one other case too, that, you know, a lot of times we think about these impression-based technology as the way, is the only option for some of our patients. But I have a patient, like one of my, let's just say my failures was a impression-based lens design. She had previously been wearing actually the PROS lens, but it was a, not because of the lens, but because of her eye. It was just a bad fit. She had, right. Entropion in her upper lid, so bad, so bad that she had some blepharons in her upper yes. Fornix, I guess you'd say.
Yes.
And she basically didn't have a superior limbus at all because there was so much scarring and thickening mm-hmm. and all of that. And basically fast forward to, like, we had like customized impression cups and everything. I could never mm-hmm. get not only an impression that was good, nor a scan that was good. I could get nothing that was good for her. And we ended up actually back to our favorite custom stable lens. Like it, and I ended up doing a straight up conventional fit to be able to uber customize the eye. So while we do like to lean on these amazing technologies, still knowing and having the resources available and the knowledge available to be creative and use every tool in your toolbox is important, because with every Absolutely. Bit of technology, I still couldn't do it because of these limitations in her eye, which
Absolutely.
Is heartbreaking because yeah. you do invest a lot of money, right?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, you know, of anybody, I love the tech, but I also, with using tech, there's limitations, and we really need both. We're not in a fully digital world yet. We're not in a fully, you know, automated AI. Like, we still need that expertise, and we still need to be able to manually make changes and fit things the way that we always have.
And understand what's wrong. There's,
and yeah. And they're all tools that are super valuable in the toolbox.
I think this is enough of this chit chat of us. I feel we need to bring in an expert. What do you say?
I think that sounds great. Let's do it. Today, we're very excited to welcome an extra special guest, David Slater, who went to school at the University of Iowa in psychology and then went on to learn on the job from Christine Sint for years, has an NCLE certification, and is the current general manager of iPrint Prosthetics. David, welcome. We're very happy to chat with you today.
Hey, thank you very much. Happy to be here.
So you've had quite a history of innovation over the years. And I know, Roya, we've both worked with David over, you know, many patients, some of them train wrecks. I mean,
most,
David,
let's be real. Actually, they are train wrecks. Like, basically, when it gets to the point of like, let's order an eye print, it's like, I am desperate. This is the last, I mean, at least in the beginning, I don't know
end
about
of
you,
the
Sheila.
Line.
In the beginning, when I was doing eye print, yes. I was just like, I don't know what else to do. We have to do iPrint. And now, obviously, it's gotten, like, there's obvious advantages to doing it earlier on, and especially on easier cases. But at least for me, that was my early days of like, David, I'm desperate. This makes zero sense. How do we do this?
And, you know, that was the early days of iPrint for sure. You know, the iPrint Pro was our first product that was really geared towards, you know, those train wreck eyes. That nothing else worked for. But, you know, as the technology developed, we definitely found that it, you know, can also work for more normal-ish eyes.
Totally. Well, for our listeners that don't know what iPrint is, can you give in your words what it is, what it's about? Give your
Absolutely.
Elevator pitch of the iPrint.
Oh boy, here we go. Yeah. So iPrint all starts with the impression for us. Everything is really based around that impression of the eye. So it starts with, you know, taking some PVS, polyvinyl siloxane. We actually have a waiting period, then place that on the surface of the eye and obtain truly an impression of the globe. So you get stuff that really can't be seen that's hidden by, say, like the tear layer or something like that when using scanning technology or something like that. Scanning obviously has its place too, but we found that impressions just capture those really tough areas like blebs or patch graphs, that kind of stuff, really well.
Absolutely.
So from there, we have a proprietary software that we actually build the lenses with. So the impressions are 3D scanned onto the computer, and then we have, like I said, custom software that we actually build the lenses with, specific to each eye, to each patient.
Isn't Amazing. The goo the same as that is used for dental molds for your teeth, for like night guards and things like that?
That is exactly correct. So night guard, or if you ever had a crown, same thing. When they take that impression of your tooth, it is a very old style of polyvinyl siloxane, though. You know, the dentists don't really want you choking on the impression compound while they're taking, you know, your tooth impression there. So the stuff of today sets up much, much quicker, whereas our impression compound really, you know, is placed onto the eye, has some flow to it so that it can fill in, quote unquote, the cavity, if you will, of the eye, and capture the true surface there.
You can't bite down in the eye, really, huh?
Right, right. Kind of tough to bite down on it there, yeah.
Okay, I want to take a second to step back, as we were just talking before we started recording. So you were a technician at University of Iowa's hospital, where Dr. Chris Sint works, let's just say you were
our good buddy Marcus Noyes too.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course. The recognitions, everyone that deserves it. But so you kind of were there during the creation of iPrint, correct? Or in the infancy,
that is true.
Would you say?
Definitely infancy. I don't know if I'd go as far as invention, but
sure.
I worked as a student tech for Dr. Sint when I was in college, and you know, she had had the concept for a long time. But definitely tested a few things on me back then, tested on herself as well, you know, different PVSs and trying different impression compounds to see what would work best.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And then, did you guys test on any other creatures besides humans? Like, how did you come up with this idea with the mold in the first place?
Great question.
Absolutely, we did. So, you know, obviously for safety testing and safety efficacy kind of stuff, we did through Nelson Laboratories. They're out in Utah, I believe. And we did initial testing through them. You know, they put it on little bunnies' eyes and rat eyes, that kind of stuff. And, you know,
did you go out and do that?
They could all still see. So,
did you go out and do it?
I didn't.
Oh, okay.
No.
Okay.
We had to write up like a whole test protocol, and they performed the whole thing.
Brilliant. Okay, so you get an impression of the eye. You send the impression to the lab. It's 3D scanned, 3D made. One thing that early on, like, especially for anyone who isn't fitting lenses or they know even vaguely of an eye print, everyone knows it costs a lot more money. But one thing that I think is super interesting for someone who doesn't know or think about this from a lab perspective is an eye print prosthetic compared to a standard scleral lens, even production time. What's the difference?
Oh, great question. So a standard scleral lens, you know, even a multifocal toric or something like that, you're talking maybe 2 to 3 minutes, maybe 4 minutes per side. Okay, so that's a total of 4 to 8 minutes in total on the lathe that's being cut. An iPrint Pro can take anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes per side, even up to an hour per side, depending on the severity of the geometry or how complex that geometry is. So therein kind of lies that higher price point for sure. The other fact that people don't think about is the number of rejects. You know, so that same lens that took an hour on the lathe could have been rejected at the end, and now we have to cut it again. So totally. In theory, you know, that's 2 hours, 3 hours. It really depends on how many rejects happen. So unfortunately, we do have quite a few rejects, as you can imagine, with these very complex lenses. So therein also lies that higher price point.
Exactly.
For sure.
Like, for perspective, if you're doing a lens, let's just say 5, because that's an easy number to divide by. You make a normal lens in 5 minutes versus an hour. You could have made so many more lenses from a lab's perspective or manufacturing perspective. Thus, the price being, you know, almost 8 times-ish cost.
Right, right.
Is valid because you can make at least that many lenses of a standard scleral lens, right?
Right. Definitely.
What are some of the most common reasons that doctors could, or maybe reasons that impressions are rejected? So if you were looking at quality of what people send you, I know that's probably sometimes almost, you guys probably have a laugh at maybe even some of the impressions sent by practitioners. What are the most common troubleshooting things that you would say for doctors that are molding?
Yeah, the biggest thing I would say is really corneal centration. As silly as it sounds, you know, getting that impression centered within the tray, you know, when you're taking that impression, is probably the number one thing that we see off. And, you know, different methods out there can, you know, people want to stitch things together is always like the big, you know, question. Can, you know, if I take it in 3 different gazes or, you know, I got good temporal here, good nasal here, can you stitch those together? Unfortunately, stitching is a lot more difficult than is really considered to be. Not only do you have to find similar geometry, you know, to link those areas, it's usually, you know, the limbus is used to kind of segment everything together when you do something like that. But it's pure extrapolation at that point. Right. And as we know, you know, the eye goes into different gazes, mm-hmm. different muscles activate, you know, the eye will change shape a little bit. So, you know, sometimes stitching is the only option, but truly iPrint doesn't do any stitching. So we really pick the best impression and just use that. So whatever is the best one, we will pick out of a grouping. And if, unfortunately, you know, if they're all pretty decentered or something like that, we do ask the doctor to take a new impression at that point.
Can you,
sometimes, you know, we get a little, go ahead.
This is gold.
I was just going to say, you know, sometimes classically it's the patient that's from like drove to see me from 18 hours away or whatever that, you know, so that can be a bit of a
heartbreak,
a trouble thing. And we'll just kind of, you know, push through it at that point if the doctor really requests that. But as often as possible, you like to get a new impression.
Can you walk us through the exact steps of taking an impression?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, absolutely. So, starts with the applicator and the little martini tray looking thing. So hold that upright. You fill with the blue goo, and then you have a waiting period of 40 seconds before you actually place that on the eye. So once 40 seconds has elapsed, that's when you're going to want to actually place that on the eye. So personally, I kind of lift the upper lid, go up underneath that, drop the lower lid, and get it into place. I kind of compare it to parallel parking a car. So it's, you know, underneath the top lid, then the lower lid. Pretty much good to go. That lower lid can be really tricky sometimes just because, you know, there's a lot of blue goo on that lower lid and, you know, it's
sliding
very
out.
Slick if you don't get to it right away. That's just one thing I'd mention.
I think, too, some pointers that I learned over time was that, number one, where the person is looking really, really matters. Because if they're looking too far up or too far down, you don't center your mold. And so their gaze or really like making them focus out of the non-impressioned eye helps. But okay, tell me what you guys think about this. I would almost always send multiple scans, not trying to say to extrapolate this, but like I would do one and I'd be like, oh, it's pretty good. But I would just do another one or two, especially for the people that traveled far. But I would just rather send three-ish impressions than send one that I thought was perfect and the lab didn't. And then I have to go back to the patient saying, and especially because they invest a good amount in this lens. So it's just considering the impression is so fast and easy, it's not worth that not going through the first time. Sheila, do you do the same?
Okay.
No, go ahead. Same for sure.
Yeah, I agree completely. In fact, we really encourage it. You know, if you have any, just say anatomical features on the eye, you know, pinguiculas, something like that, it can tell us, yes, this is real, or no, this is actually conjugalasis or something like that. So, you know, one impression may have a slightly different look, which tells us, okay, either, you know, the tissue is manipulated by the impression or truly it's just an artifact completely. So we really do like to get a couple impressions if possible, unless, I mean, you're just literally perfect on that one.
Totally. Yeah.
With conjunctival prolapse and chalazosis, do you have any tips for getting practitioners to pull that tissue away? Like at one point, I have a patient who we're trying to redo an impression for that has kind of a bunchy conjunctival tissue. And so we've kind of been exploring pulling it back just a little bit with a Q-tip to get it to be a little bit smoother. But I mean, that's maybe not their natural state. Do you have any suggestions for them?
You know, sometimes it is unavoidable. Truly, if a patient has a lot of redundant conjunctiva, it's just something you got to overcome. Now, on our side, we can do some post-processing, which is nice. So, I mean, your goal as a practitioner is, you know, get as good an impression as possible. And you tell us, I mean, this is as good as I can do. Or, okay, so we'll go ahead and, you know, smooth out that area or ignore that data there and actually fill it in. So while we don't stitch, we can edit data that's, you know, exists on the impression to make it work better for our process, for sure. But you bring up an excellent point as far as kind of, you know, it's just loose skin realistically, right? So, you know, you kind of just got to pull that out of the way. The other big one is tear pooling. And that's what we usually use Q-tips for is, you know, kind of wick those tears out before the impression actually goes onto the eye and really as it's being taken as well.
Absolutely.
So tears can get trapped underneath in the goo?
Oh yeah, big time. They're pretty funny looking. You'll have like this perfect little, you know, circle divot thing. You're like, what is that?
Weird.
It's just the perfect tear capture or something like that.
It's just pulled up like a bubble,
yeah,
under like sticker or something, right?
Literally.
What about what about digital scans with the impressions? How useful is that for the lab? I know in our clinic, we'll send over sometimes both and have you look at a scan that's digital and also an impression that we take. How useful is that to you? Do you combine them together when you get both?
So we can't combine them, but it is extremely helpful, again, as an example of anatomical features on the eye. I can think of one from your clinic recently that we actually were going to reject the impression, but after, you know, reviewing the eaglet scan next to it, you know, there was a pinguicular bit of an elevation, kind of superior temporal in that eye that was both, you know, in the eaglet scan and on the impression. And turns out the lens fit quite well. I heard back from the doc too there. So, super helpful.
So more data is definitely better than less. So you guys take it all in and we're not wasting our time by taking all the extra scans to send into you. That's good to know.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. We do utilize everything you send. So
what about,
too much is not even enough.
It can never be too much.
It can never be enough.
What about impression rings? So do you know very much about, how long would you say you take your patients out of lenses before you either do a refit, take an impression or a scan for a new contact lens?
For me, I always say as long as possible, right? Like,
yeah.
But most people, unfortunately, are super dependent. So I can't remember what my rule was, but I think it was like at least ideally a week, at least a long weekend, the longer the better. That's sort of what I know. That's kind of a soft rule. I don't know. What is the real rule, David?
What is the science, David? So because we do, and just largely because patients are so dependent, how do you convince somebody who's working during the week to take that kind of time off? And so we sadly only require 48 hours as the bare minimum. And of course, we encourage people to take more time off than that if they can. And some do, but some just don't. Some even come in and say they took the time off and then you take the scan. And David, you know, you actually busted one of my patients not that long ago saying, that's an impression. I'm like, no, my patient, I know this guy. He's actually friends with my uncle in Southern Alberta. And he's a good, honest, trustworthy patient.
He's a liar.
And you're like, yeah. And I'm like, no, he definitely took his time off. I asked him. And then when I went back after you said, are you sure? He admitted to me that he wore his lenses the night before for a bit on the farm and also drove with them to the clinic and then took them off before he came in. So what does the science say? I know actually, David, you had a cool abstract at ARVO in 2023 summer that was about, I think you guys compared, I think John Gellies was an author on that, looking at tissue deformation. There's not a whole lot in the literature. I know Greg Dinaire has looked into that too. What did your study say and what do you think the answer is for that?
I'm going to have to go back and look at that study. I don't remember exactly, but our absolute minimum is 48 hours out of lenses, just like you said. I mean, that is our minimum as well. So ideally, the longer the better, just like we've all heard right here, but 48 hours is the absolute minimum. Now, depending on, let's just say, how bad a fit can be, or depending on the lens modality that they were wearing previously, we do sometimes require a little bit more. You know, we've found that, you know, like corneal GPs, for instance, you won't have any problems with the sclera, but you'll definitely have problems with like corneal rebound, more or less, you know, that RX will change underneath the scleral lens. Now, if they, you know, wear a scleral lens, obviously that's the exact area we're fitting. So that can have major impact implications on our fit at that point. Another one that, you know, is kind of funny, but say, you know, patient goes out of their lens for that period of time, you get the impression. Well, during that time, while iPrints manufacturing a lens, et cetera, a couple of weeks go by, well, the patient starts wearing their old lens again. And, you know, you dispense that first lens and it might not fit super well in that first dispense. So that's something to just consider as well, you know, what the patient's wearing in between that impression time and the iPrint lens dispense, if that makes sense.
Good call. Totally makes sense. So yeah. So then actually, so we do not have patients discontinue lens wear before they come in for their first dispense. And so that actually could have a big impact. I mean, we try to, we say it's always better, but the reality is that some people just don't. So I think that's actually a really good reminder for practitioners whenever possible. If you want to get clean data, have them, you know, come in for their dispense before they put their lens in, if whenever possible, bring a driver, all those usual things. Absolutely.
Well, yeah, I think realistically with a lens with this much technology, you can't make quick decisions, right? Like every decision needs to be a bit methodical. Like we can make a little bit more rash decisions with a standard scleral lens, but with this, A, considering the investment, B, considering production time, you know, I feel like you have to just be very thoughtful about the changes you make and the decisions you make and the follow-up, like a little extra follow-up, because it is so much technology and it is such a, you know, glove, perfect glove fit or fingerprint fit, sometimes I would say. So when someone is investing that much, for me, it wasn't really hard to tell someone you really shouldn't be wearing your lenses for at least X amount of time. If you do, it's on you, right? Like this is your, it's going to be your lens because we're creating it from a mold. And so I don't care what you do, but you will, right? So there's nothing I can do to lie and fix what you do, right? I know that sounds a little harsh, but it just is what it is. And most of the time, when someone's paying for a much more expensive lens than they're used to, they're going to follow the rules better. But unless they're told that, they don't know. They don't understand why. Because for other lenses, it really doesn't make quite as big of a difference. Or you can kind of get around it, or you can assume different changes that are going to happen or whatever. So that's at least the way I kind of like to phrase it.
I mean, people don't even think twice about going in for some surgery and being told, you know, no food this many hours before. There's all these other things, depending on what surgery you're having, it's not negotiable. This is probably one of my number one take homes are like for listeners to just in communication, like you said, Roya, to be able to, you know, not sugarcoat that and like require it, not recommend it.
Totally.
I think for the best, fastest outcomes.
Totally. Let's also...
And to go back to that ARVO abstract, that was exactly what we looked at. So that tissue deformation, particularly we were comparing previous scleral lens wearers to virginize, as we called it in the abstract poster there. And we definitely found that it took more lenses to get to a successful endpoint with a patient who had worn scleral lenses in the past. You know, so it was pretty interesting to see. You know, we want to do some follow-ups to that to see how long was a patient out of the lens before, you know, do some further digging into that topic for sure.
Guys, this is very synonymous to ortho-K fitting actually, because you cannot just switch a patient over from one design to another and expect any form of success on the first day. It just doesn't fit. And it, in fact, it costs a lot more time in the long term rather than a clean washout when needed. No lenses before, and I've learned that lesson the hard way many times. And so totally important messages.
Nothing like a multi-month like draw out on your, because of yourself, right? You're like, let's skip a step.
Yeah, everybody's mad. Everybody's
4 months
mad
later, you're like, why did I break my
It's for the best
protocol.
Intentions. You want to make people happy in the moment.
Like,
they just don't want to be without it. You want to tell them, yes, you can just continue on life as it is. But the reality, these are medical devices. It's not just that simple. I mean, if you think about what we're doing and matching that eye shape within, you know, how accurate actually is the eye print for microns to the eye? So if we're matching an eye shape to that level of accuracy, this is not a small game, you know?
Yeah, the compound itself is accurate 1 to 2 microns, literally, and the scanner is accurate to about 7. So in theory, you know, we're about between 7 and 10
darn
microns
good.
To the eye, something like that. Yeah,
darn
good.
Is
we can say that.
That's better than what I thought. I think I've even actually said higher numbers on the podium before, like around, like more closer to up to 10 for eye print. So this is good learning. I'm glad to have this conversation. Yeah. Update
Tell
all the numbers. That's very accurate.
I love it. Tell me, as a, like, let's just call it a, like, highly customized scleral lens designer, okay? What are some pointers that you could give, even for general scleral lens fitting, that people maybe don't think about, right? Maybe it's around a pinguecula or the limbus or what, just, like, general things that when you're getting your scan and designing something that maybe that's why they were successful with the previous scleral lens. I don't know. Any pointers for general scleral lenses?
So limbus for sure. One that I always bring up with iPrint to just consider, and really for any scleral lens out there. So, you know, classically, let's say you have a lens that's looking tight temporal or something like that. They have a nasal pinguicula. Most of the time people are going to want to flatten like that temporal side, right, to relieve that pressure. But what they should really be thinking about in my mind is look at the nasal side, look at the other side of the eye that's higher in elevation, that's forcing that lens to move temporal, right? So a lot of the time, if you flatten that nasal side, you'll actually get the lens to center up better in that case. That's something I always like to consider, especially with pinguicula patients or something like that. True with blebs and stuff like that too. You know, you have this big superior, huge superior elevation, let's just say, or patch graph, something like that. That can really have a lot of effect on a lens, you know, eyelid one blinking over, but then that big elevation kind of forcing the lens down as well. So, the other piece I would just mention is, you know, taking OCTs in different gazes. Our impressions taken in primary gaze. And that's one thing, you know, as often as possible, we like to get OCTs in primary gaze, if possible. You know, it's easier to identify the limbus as you have a patient go into secondary gazes or something like that. But as we know, lenses do tend to translate a little bit. You know, you look down, your lens translates up. You look up, your lens translates down. So it can be a little artificial sometimes with those OCTs. So I think, you know, having good slit lamp evaluation, good fluorescein evaluation is really important, along with OCT, to just make sure, you know, clearing everywhere.
I love that. Honestly, like, to go back to your first tip, so many people, like, or even people that like reach out to me asking for tips, look at the problem in isolation, like look at an edge in isolation and are not looking at all of the edges. So they'll be like, oh, there's horizontal impingement. I need to flatten that area. And I'm like, well, what about the vertical axis? Like, and they're like, I didn't look up under the lid. It's like, what in the world? Like, that is literally the most underappreciated edge, in my opinion. I don't know about you, Sheila.
Underappreciated.
Like, I think it's underappreciated. Like, no one looks under the lid. I'm like, what do you mean you didn't look there? Like, that is probably the loose edge. Yeah, they're like, it's decentered inferiorly and it's really tight on the horizontal axis. It's like, well, it probably is loose up under the lid. So anyways, I think that you need to just appreciate everywhere, especially look at the opposite angle, you know, 180 degrees away, but don't just think of one edge in alone, because 99% of the time is not just from that edge alone. Like, quadrant specific changes. I don't know. I'm going to say this and I feel pretty strongly about it. And I know both of you are going to be like, no, this is crazy. But I don't think even a regular eye most of the time doesn't need a quadrant specific change for most eyes, because most lenses can fit with a toric change, a toric haptic. While it is technically much more quadrant irregular, a toric haptic usually fits really nicely, but you just have to actually fit it well and recognize all edges do make a difference to nicely fit the edges. I don't know. I know that the studies don't necessarily back that, but you can get a great fitting lens for most people with toric haptics alone, without quadrant specific changes, if you're really paying attention to every edge. You can say your piece.
Well, I think it was the Visser group that showed that in the past. Was it not?
Probably.
They were the first. Yeah, so that group is the first one that came up with the toric haptic and, you know, better centration, less fogging, that whole story. Right. I don't disagree with you, actually. I think that on most eyes. So the like caveat that I'll throw out there is that there are eyes that doesn't necessarily apply to, 100%. But on average, most eyes that do have that asymmetrical shape still are, it's not clinically like different enough that you cannot be successful with a toric haptic. I do agree. I'm going to ask you guys, both of you, a really, ask for another clinical pearl. How about for inferior decentration? Because we see it so commonly. And David, you're talking about looking at the opposite edge of where the affected trouble spot is. What are your top tips for general scleral lens fitting, both of you, for decentration that's vertical?
Yeah, that's a tough one to combat sometimes, I tell you.
It is, because gravity, you know, that, as I always tell students, yeah, the big
gravity,
belly wants
that
to
upper
hang
lid.
Low. Yeah.
It sure does. Especially you got like a low cone or something like that. It's like you're almost, in some respects, again, it's unavoidable, kind of like we talked about with conchalasis. But, you know, for us, you know, we've looked at some things with like steepening haptics, et cetera. You know, sometimes docs want to steepen like the inferior superior, and it can work. I haven't seen that works, at least in iPrint. It doesn't seem to work 100% of the time by any means. What I've more seen with us is with that inferior decentration or something like that is some misidentification perhaps of the limbus. So, you know, with the impression, you get this really, obviously you get the whole eye, but you get that limbal area that you're trying to define. And so if it's a little bit washed out inferiorly, if they did have some chalasis or some conj billowing over the limbus or something like that, it can be extremely hard to identify. So, because it's kind of a width of an area too, right? And that's kind of the funny thing. So in some respects, it's unavoidable, but that's usually what I look at is those limbal points and the limbal width going on in the areas.
So which is bigger, which is smaller usually? Is the horizontal, like is the vertical usually actually smaller than the lens limbus or the opposite?
So your VVID is, I mean, in a normal eye, is pretty much always shorter than your HVID. So, you know, most patients have some variance there. I mean, no eye is like completely spherical or round. So there is always a little bit of variance there. Now, some have a lot more than others. But
right.
Yeah. Yeah. So we actually do identify the limbus as a hyperbolic paraboloid in the iPrint software, which is a really cool feature.
Super dorky. I love that.
Yeah, yeah. We used to do a planar circle, but now it's more of like a bent Pringle shape. So it's an elliptical shape with a little bit of bend because your 3 and 9 areas are actually lower in elevation than your 12-6 limbal areas.
Sense.
So it's there's, you know, actual change there.
Makes sense. Yeah, for me, Sheila, sometimes changing diameters can make a big difference. You could argue that bigger could help center better, but I also find that sometimes smaller can help center better. It just depends on the corneal size, of course. But it is tricky. And honestly, for me, my biggest awareness of decentration, there's the obvious bads that are hard to fix. But for me, starting to fit higher order aberration lenses or multifocals, mm-hmm. that's when you are just like screaming for help on like, how do I center this lens and realizing how poorly it centers because decentered optics
the
just
optics
don't
off.
Work. Right. Exactly. Yeah. It's so much more complicated when your optics aren't centered. So what you think is you're a good fitter, then you start adding higher order powers and, you know, multifocals and whatever. And you're like, I literally have no idea what I'm doing and I need to go to a course or something. That's when I like started getting insecure about like, what are my skills? And I had a really nice, you know, learning curve again.
Come to Jesus.
Yeah. Like that is when you realize that I don't know what I'm doing. Like, am I actually a bad fitter? And then you start realizing how to center a little
better. I think
it's
a sign of becoming more. So you, yeah, coming to that place where it's like the whole idea behind science is the more questions you answer reveal the more questions that there are. So I think, right, that actually is a sign of you becoming a better fitter by being self-aware enough that you know what you don't know all of a sudden again.
Well,
like circle back and
having
then,
Oh, 100%. Well, and when you have the conversation with, you know, David or like, you know, some of the different people that we work with as we're designing lenses and they're like, looking at your scan and the how your lens is fitting on the eye, your lens is, you know, X percent decenter or like, and they're telling you the imperfections and you're like, you want to defend yourself, but you can't, right? You know what I mean? Like, you're like, dang it, I'm really...
How dare you?
Right, what are you trying to say? It was the patient's fault or whatever. But it's true. It's important. And I think that as newer technologies are coming out and becoming readily available in many different lens manufacturer and many different companies as well, I think that's bringing up how important it is to fit and center the lens if possible.
Data in, that's one thing that came up a lot at the GSLS recently. And in our practice, definitely in the last, you know, really analyzing and truly we sometimes owe a huge apology to David and our other good friends in labs for the data that we send because any of the technology is only as good as the output is as good as the input.
100%.
And so we can blame our, you know, the lens or the lab or whatever for these lenses that come back fitting kind of with funny things. But when you really analyze, there's been a few that I've gone back to very recently trying to make the office more efficient, try to fewer redos, everything that we all want. And in not that this is necessarily surprising, but it kind of was at some of the data that was sent in when we really look closely at it and be, you know, because sometimes you have, not that the technicians would do anything different than I would, but there's a whole bunch of different hands that touch data in our practice before it goes to the lab. And sometimes there's parts of that I don't even look at. And so it's a good like reminder to, you know, retrain your staff every 3 months for when there's new people that come in to learn what is good quality, what is bad quality, in particular
Absolutely.
With scans, even
Absolutely.
Simple things. And that's no different than corneal topography back in the day when trying to come up with the best ways to fit good ortho-K or, you know, corneal GPs. You know, we have to have good data to have good lenses.
I love that. Let's talk
actually
a second.
Would want the, yeah, yeah.
Let's, I just wanted to talk a second about the different, because iPrint Pro is the original.
iFriend
is the original lens available, but there's now iFit Pro and a ScanFit Pro. And I want to hear from your perspective when when is it worth the quote unquote step down to the iFit Pro, sort of like the differences and when to do them?
Yeah. So again, iPrint Pro, as you mentioned earlier, is like the flagship product, the first one we started with, really for like those train wreck eyes that nothing else is working for. Now, iFit was our secondary foray into impression-based lenses. So it is about a third of the cost of iPrint Pro, but also is more for normal, more normalized, let's call it that. So smaller pinguiculas, smaller elevations, you know, you're, as Dr. Sitt likes to say, you're just a cone eyes or something like that. iFit is probably the number one lens we actually do use for HOA correction, you know, for keratoconic patients or really anyone that is requiring HOAs, but that's the
majority
big population out there at the moment that we've been working with. So iFit is cut with less points. So it's lower resolution is the big thing. So your iPrint Pro is anywhere between, it's probably like 500,000 plus data points. I was going to say 500,000 to a million, but it really comes down to how big the lens is. So diameter, as you get bigger, you'll just have more data points, right? Because it's just rings and rings of data. The iFit is cut with about half that. So it's anywhere in the range of like 100,000 to 300,000 points, something like that would be my comparison there. So what that means is from the impression surface, less sampling is done of the for the lens. Okay, so for the iPrint Pro, it utilizes a lot more points that are on the impression surface, where the iFit doesn't use as many just because it's not really needed for those kind of eyes. So the resolution of an iFit, again, is about half of what the iPrint Pro is. Now for ScanFit, that one is completely based on scans of the eye. So we do not use impressions for ScanFit. That is utilized with both Oculus CSP and then the Eaglet ESP as well. So both those topographers, profilometers, are useful with the ScanFit technology there. So with that one, it's a fork of the iPrint software, and it actually can exist in the doctor's hands as well, which is really cool. So you can design your own lenses if you'd like with ScanFit, which is a little bit different than iFit or iPrint Pro that we currently, you know, keep in-house.
Very cool. Very cool. So sometimes if you're not sure, it could be a discussion after you get the impression, hey, what do you think I really need to go for an iPrint, or can I go to the iFit and you guys could kind of discuss? Or does that come up very often?
It does happen once in a while. In my mind, like if you're questioning whether it's like, oh, is it iFit or iPrint? It's probably an iPrint, I hate to say. Yeah. But, you know, you kind of know the iFits, you know, just a small little 3.9 pinguiculas or, you know, a cone that you're having trouble getting over, you know, because with iFit, you can do those decentered back optics to get up and over like a low cone or something like that, or a tilted graft, you know, something like that, that a traditional lens isn't going to quite clear.
Yeah, totally.
How would practitioners get high level optics, or so I guess HOA and multifocals, into these lenses?
So we use or we work with two aberrometer companies out there. The first was Ovitz and the second is Wavefront Dynamics. So with Ovitz, we've been working with them since 2020 was the initial clinical trials with them. So with their process, we have to send a lens with base dots on it. So it has 10 dots in a particular array around the optic zone that are, you know, filled in with ink. And I think both of you have experience using the Ovitz X-Wave. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, from there, you send that information off to Ovitz. Then they actually send us a file that we incorporate into our cut file in-house and then cut the lens at that point.
So translation, now with they send you a recipe, you input. Easy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. It's a very simple process there. Now with Wave Dynamics, what we actually do is send a lens. So there's no extra dots needed with Wave Dynamics. They just have the single right eye and the double dot on the left eye. They use that and the lens edge to find centration with that rather than using dots, which is a different process there. But they then, you know, do the aberrometry through the lens. We actually send our cut file to Wavefront Dynamics. They rewrite it, put their optics in the optic zone, and then send that back to us, and then we cut the lens. So just a little bit different process there to get to that HOA end result.
Very cool. Very interesting. All options. I mean, I will say, like, as a just something I observed as patients came in, whether they had gotten fit from other people or Maybe I refit them. I noticed I had a patient that was refit in one of her eyes. She was unhappy with her vision in her scleral lenses, just in one eye. Let's just say it was 20/30 vision. I don't remember the exact case. She had keratoconus. So we refit her in one eye only to the eye print, and she got 20/25 plus vision with a spherical power. Then fast forward, her left eye, I don't remember what happened, but changed. And at the time, it was when I was in beta testing with Ovitz. So I refit her left eye with the Ovitz lens, and now she has better vision in her left eye than her right eye with the higher order aberration lens. I want to say first, I think that the better vision with the eye print came from better centrated, like the lens was centered better, right? That alone helps vision. So when sometimes the patient gets referred, or you refer a patient for an Ovitz fitting because of vision, it usually is a fit issue, not necessarily that Ovitz is at the moment, or at least prior to some of these higher order aberrations. It's not like the lens can give you any better optics beyond sphere or cylindrical correction. It's just that a fit really matters. The optics really matter where it's centered over the pupil. And the Ovitz does amazing, or Ovitz, sorry, the eye print prosthetic, because the fit's so beautiful right away, it centers the optics beautifully, patient's happy. Now you add higher order aberration, and that's just the cherry on top, right? Actually, Dr. Right. John Gelly said something. He said that even a 20/20 or 20/25 vision, if the patient's complaining, it's like listening to someone who's talking with muffled voice versus non-muffled, the HOA correction. So you have as perfect shape as you could with a impression base. And then now you add the best possible vision that's going to be really centered, and you don't have to necessarily be the one to figure out a perfect fit. But I just like to say that to people who don't totally understand a scleral lens fitting, that fit really matters, and you can do it oftentimes with a standard scleral lens or conventional scleral lens, but that's the visual limitation is kind of twofold, right?
Yeah, I just want to mention it's wild, you know. So a lot of times when doctors order, I failed to mention how we get power for the lenses. So we do have you place a known, you know, rigid lens on the eye, known base curve and power, then just over-refract that. If you have a patient who's wearing a lens, you can just give us that information. But I can't tell you how often it happens that we get an order, their lens has front toric in it, and we'll put that into the lens since it's needed. But by lens number two, when they're ordering that revised iPrint Pro or iFit Pro, they're kicking all the sill out. It's crazy. You know, they'll go from like two diopters to like half a diopter or even one diopter a sill. So you'll literally knock out half to three quarters of what they needed in a previous lens. It's something. So centration, you're right, is key to getting good optics, but also then honestly for HOA correction to go beyond that, you need good centration for that as well.
Absolutely.
David, if aside from the tip that OCT, you like to see OCT in primary gaze, do you have two other top tips for practitioners when communicating with the lab for lens adjustments?
Oh, good question. Good one. Troubleshooting.
Yeah, troubleshooting.
How do you want to be spoken to? What are the best ways for us to tell you what we need?
You know, truly just giving information that is pertinent. You know, that's another thing that's just kind of funny. You know, sometimes you'll get you'll get 30 images in an email too sometimes where it's like they just needed an over-refraction. I would say sometimes, you know, depending on the level of what's needed for something, because that's very daunting to a consultant to see 30 attachments to something.
Well, then you're responsible for it. So you see all these pictures and all this stuff, and maybe the doctor's just saying, I just need an over-refraction, but then you notice, but then all of a sudden now there's all these other things. So I guess it's useful in some ways, but it gets a little muddy.
It can be. It sure can be. So that's one thing too, is like, you know, kind of knowing or filtering what goes to the consultant, I suppose, at that point, if you just mm-hmm. want an over-refraction, relay
just
that,
say it.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be one for me. Another would be letting a lens settle enough,
yes.
I would say. I get a lot of, you know, OCTs are, you know, well, the clearance was 330 microns. Well, what was the wearing time on that? I'm like, oh, it was 5 minutes or 30 minutes
yes.
or 20 minutes. Like, you know, ideally we like to see at least an hour or two on the eye. You know, I mean, ideal would be like at least four, you know, because yeah. that way, you know, like here's what it's going to be at the end of the day. Because, you know, initial dispense doesn't always tell you a whole lot as far as where that lens is going to end
up. Agreed.
Especially just like we talked about, if they were wearing that previous lens or something like that, you know, there's a lot of factors at play there.
Absolutely. Well, I feel like anyone listening that's, you know, interested or fitting scleral lenses at least has one thing that they've learned today. So I really appreciate your wisdom and knowledge. How do people learn more, whether it be about your products or from you? How do they learn more or connect with you if they have questions?
Absolutely. Please feel free to reach out via email. I don't know if that's something that I can just say. Yeah. Or,
and we'll link it in the show
notes.
It's
just my first name. Okay, perfect. It's just my first name, david@iprintpro.com. So any questions on iPrint, fitting stuff, I love it all. So please.
Awesome.
Lovely.
Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Hey, thank you both. It was a real honor to be here. Thank you.
Well, we've come to the end for today. We want to hear from you, so please reach out to us with your feedback, questions, stories, things you're interested in hearing from us, either through our Instagram or Facebook. And we can't close today's show without saying thanks to Valley Contacts for both making great products and for being amazing people to work with. Be sure to tune in and listen to our next episodes. But until then, try not to blink.